What Does Law Mean, Mumu? The podcast series. Hello, this is Pauline Marinan here, continuing this podcast series of discussions about the chapters in the book, What Does Law Mean, Mumu? An Introduction to the Law for Young People, hoping that the podcast discussions will provide you with some additional background information and perhaps lead to further thought and further curiosity on your part about some of the subjects. In Chapter 4, as you will recall, it was a visit to the courts, Lady Justice, wigs and gowns, the snail and the ginger beer, women in the law. And in that discussion, we decided to go to the centre of the activity, to the theatre on which a lot of the court cases are played out and where a lot of the legal processes can be witnessed. And so we went to the four courts in Dublin, the centre of the city, where these imposing courts stand, representing the halls of justice where people go to have their rights vindicated or where the prosecution is taken against a person who has broken the law on a criminal case, a criminal act. And so we discussed Lady Justice, this extraordinary statue that has prevailed through time, rises above, sits blindfolded or otherwise, above or in front of courthouses throughout the world. And even to this day in countries like Brazil, where new modern architecture, beautiful sculpted courthouses have been built in modern design outside in equally modern impressionist design or modern design, there are statues of Lady Justice in all these different guises. And what it basically is, a message that here in these halls, in these courts of justice, justice and fairness is dispensed equally. Her scales of justice represent the proper balance. We will discuss in detail the different kinds of evidence, where it's on the balance of probabilities, if it's a civil case, or whereas in a criminal case, the test on which the evidence is based, test against which it must be tried, is beyond a reasonable doubt. In other words, there can be no doubt in the minds of the juries and the judge of the guilt. And if there is, then a not guilty finding must be made. And so this representative statue that used to be maintained by great emperors in their palaces as a symbol to show to people how good they were and the kind of principles that they maintained at times when they weren't affording those principles, those equalities to women. Interesting. And as one of the learners suggested when we discussed this in the chapter, a fine example of hypocrisy. We discussed the wigs and gowns, the fact that the old horsehair wigs have been there since almost medieval times. And there is an element of medieval about the way barristers and judges dress, because, of course, in the olden days, barristers would have been very close to being clerical people. They would be like the clergy. They were above question. They were not even paid fees. They were paid an honorarium, which is why to this day a barrister can never sue for her or his fees. It is a solicitor who engages the barrister, because a solicitor is the person on the high street to whom the general public go if they have a case. But they take care of things like conveyancing and wills and all the other business of the law. And they don't really have time to do court work, although they have a right of audience to appear in court and can, in certain jurisdictions, including in Ireland, have the right of audience to appear right up to the highest courts. But the barrister's gowns have, the junior counsel gowns, have a little pouch that hangs down. People would think it's just something you would use to hang up the gown on a hook. But at the back of the gown is this little pouch. It's actually a secret pouch purse. And it's where, in the olden days, the client would drop the fee to the barrister, which was a guinea, paid in guineas, which a guinea was £1, 1 shilling, so 21 shillings. And in those days, the fees were put at the back. In other words, barristers were not going to have too much overtly to do with being seen to be taking money. It was more that they were doing this and just being paid a very honourable amount for their services. Interesting times. The senior counsel's gown is different. It's made of silk, it has straight long sleeves, and it has a straight collar cut straight at the back. So the reluctance by the judiciary, members of the bar, to do away with the wigs was interesting. And the group of learners asked about that. Why was there such a reluctance to move on and change? And in many respects, you could say that it was to do with a desire to keep that world separate, to have it seen as different, seen as a very somber, serious place. Some speculated that maybe a lot of members of the judiciary liked the anonymity that the Whigs gave and provided for them, particularly when they were handing down difficult judgments in divorce cases or other kinds of cases, if they lived in a small community or in a small country where they would be easily recognised. So it has been slow to change, as indeed has the attitude to women. And we talk in that chapter about women in the law. And I ask you now, in listening to this, to make a distinction in your mind between women in the law, that is, women progressing their careers through the law, and the other topic, which is very different, which is women and the law, and that is how the law has treated women or mistreated them, failed to vindicate their rights, failed to treat them equally over the years. And that has also been slow to change. But as we know, that has to do with the legislature, that has to do with the laws being changed by the parliamentarians who represent the people to properly have laws to uphold fair policies in parity of pay, for example, and all the other inequalities that we go into in Chapter 4, where women have certainly been very slow to receive the protection of the law in terms of equal rights and equal pay. In many respects, that whole area about women in the law was held back because of an Act of 1919 called the Sex Disqualification Act. And 1919, the Sex Disqualification Act was removed. So last year, on the end of November 2019, it was 100 years since the removal of that Act. And that Act basically prevented women from being lawyers simply on the basis of their sex. It prevented them from doing a lot of other things, like being members of a jury and being other holding other offices, if you like, other officerships in the court and in administration. And when that Act was removed, there was a huge surge forward in women. In fact, very shortly after the removal of that Act came through, four women who had first-class honours degrees from Cambridge University headed straight to get the law exams that they were entitled then to sit and pass them and be enrolled as solicitors, as it happened at that time. It also really applied to women in many professions, ultimately, such as accountancy and other professions where women were held back on grounds of simply being a woman. And many of those professions were represented in dinners throughout the United Kingdom, Ireland, and other territories that would have had that Act prevailing, colonial territories at the time, who would have been affected by it. And of course, in 1919, Ireland had not yet fully achieved its full independence from the United Kingdom, and so that Act would have applied there. And I believe from the history that's been told that I think the first women to become solicitors as a result of the removal of the Act actually came from the Republic of Ireland. And then a number of barristers as well came from that change in the law. And so in many respects, we can say that there were significant changes to propose women as being eligible to be lawyers, but still many obstacles remained. And no discussion about women in the law can happen without reference to this wonderful professor who wrote this famous book, Professor Glanville Williams, who was a professor of law at Cambridge University, whose little book called Learning the Law was almost like a little Bible that everybody studying law had to have in the 1970s, 80s and onwards. And in the edition that I refer to in the book in Chapter 4 and quote from, you will read the comments he made about women and the law, women in the law. And that is at the back of the book, relegated to the very end, when, among other things, he says that women really shouldn't be thinking about being barristers because, first of all, they have the prejudice of the solicitors to deal with. Then they have the prejudice of the clients. And actually, they're quite diminutive. They can't really be seen at the back of the court. And they have very poor voices. They can't be heard in court. And they really don't give vent to their anger. They don't talk and argue in a robust way unless they're annoyed. And anyway, their voices don't carry. So any reference to women making it as lawyers always has to include the quotes of Glanville Williams, who seems to have had a very strong inclination to prevent women from becoming members of the bar. Mind you, he's failed, and he's failed drastically. And I think with great pleasure it was that I was able to give the figures in Chapter 4 to the young band of learners about the numbers of women who are now represented on the bench, as they say, represented in the judiciary as judges, and in other high office, as I point out. But a third of the judiciary in the Republic of Ireland are women, and I think 30% in England and Wales at the last count. And so they are now fairly represented on the bench, which was quite a significant breakthrough when you consider that there were so many of these barriers to women progressing. And from a social history point of view, if you look at the fact that there were so many all-male clubs, all-male preserves, where women couldn't be members of golf clubs, tennis clubs, dining clubs, and the marriage bar on women who had to leave their jobs if they worked in the civil service when they got married. And so there were many, many obstacles there that prevented women from progressing, had to give up their jobs, or indeed even being able to mingle with the people who were the top of the professions, the people who were the influencers, who would have been members of all of those all-male preserves. So there was this barrier, as there would be in class or in any kind of racial divide. It was a form of elitism. In this instance, we're referring to it in the context of the gender divide. And you can see that it did actually provide a great block to women progressing once they even had the right to get into the profession. Progressing was round two. So notwithstanding all those obstacles, they have managed to progress and prevail. And I hope you find the contents of Chapter 4 interesting. And I encourage you, please, to continue to probe, be curious about these subjects and read more about them. And perhaps, if you had time, have a look at the Sex Disqualification Removal Act of 1919, I beg your pardon, and think of how, in the 100 years since then, how women have progressed and how significant 1919 was shortly after women got the vote. And also, an interesting again connection, in 2019, we also were celebrating the 10th anniversary of the UN Convention of the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Very interesting to look at that. And as soon as I've said that, I know, and indeed I hope, that you'll be saying, but there are many ways and many instances where women are still discriminated against. And of course, you are perfectly correct. And most recently, one story comes to mind, and that is of a woman who was a journalist, and is a journalist in the BBC, who took an equal pay claim, a discrimination on grounds of her pay parity with her male colleagues, because the way it's always gauged is the same pay for the same work if you're assessing a case which is a claim for equal pay. And under the legislation, she was able to show, demonstrate to the satisfaction of the tribunal that the work she did, the exact same work was being done by male colleagues, but they were being paid more. So she made quite a significant finding there and has opened the pathway for a lot of other women in that area of work. Talking about the case against Volkswagen, I just recall a case that never goes out of my mind when everybody talks about Volkswagen Beetles being such an interesting, unique car in history and will be one of the designs that's long, long discussed in its unique shape with the engine at the back and its funny sound of engine sound. But a case that came before me when I was the Insurance Ombudsman of Ireland was of a couple who had bought a yellow Volkswagen Beetle. The circumstances of the case very briefly were that the husband had come up for retirement and had always dreamt of having a yellow Volkswagen Beetle. And he was given a gratuity at the time of his retirement, had some money, and in the agreement of his wife, who wanted to give him a present anyway to celebrate his retirement. I can never really fully understand why people celebrate retiring, but that's another story. And they bought the yellow Beetle. So he was so proud of it They drove to collect his pension on a Thursday. They drove for special Sunday outings. They drove to visit people. But the car was shined and polished and highly maintained. And it was indeed, as she said in her own words, his pride and joy. Parked inside the gate of their house until one evening, some thugs came passing by and opened the gate, managed to roll the car out, rolled it down a hill and set it alight. And the couple made a claim under their insurance policy only to find that they were not covered. And the reason that they weren't covered was, when the case was investigated, was A, the policy had been sold to them by an independent insurance broker, which was round one of their problems, in that the insurance ombudsman scheme, similar to the one in the United Kingdom at that time in the 1990s, didn't include brokers who were not covered by the scheme. So I had no jurisdiction over the broker. And the broker insisted, showed, demonstrated copies of the proposal form where there was a place on the form where the person who was going to take out the policy had to sign what they were buying, had to sign what they were applying for. And it was third party. And the second column where they had to tick the box was fire and theft. And the wife was absolutely 100% sure that when she had bought the previous car that they had then sold, she had ticked for both and thought that she had ticked for both in the second time. Nevertheless, there was no tick in the box and they weren't covered for fire and theft. So the unfortunate climax of that story was that I could not help them. With a very heavy heart, the facts remained that the insurance policy that they had bought and paid for, was only a third-party claim, and they had no cover at all for fire and theft. So we all had a very heavy heart in the office, I remember, about that case, because there was a small suspicion that maybe the broker had known. And because he was fearful of losing the sale, because they might not have been able to have afforded the higher cost, as times had changed since they had bought their previous policy, that he had just sold them the limited cover, thinking they wouldn't need the additional cover. But we had no way of proving that. So that was a rather difficult case, difficult one to come to terms with, because there wasn't any way that I could provide a remedy. And I knew, deep in my heart, that there was no question of that widow being able to take a case to court about it, because she could never have afforded to do so. And you notice I say widow because shortly after the incident, her husband passed away. And of course, the way she described it at the time, she said, "I think he died of a broken heart." Not too difficult to believe or to understand. But that's a difficult one whenever you can't provide a remedy, when you're in that kind of a position and there just was no way we could help. So that's an interesting case to bear in mind about the need to examine forms to be sure of what you're actually applying for, to be sure that what you have ticked is what you wanted, and to double check the form before you leave it to make sure that you haven't been sold anything less than you need or more than you need. And we might discuss that kind of case at a later stage. I look forward to talking to you again. Thank you very much. Bye for now.